Accession number 27797, Mr. Maurice Franklin, Reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Franklin?
I was born in 30th of March 1920 in Shoreditch, the east end of London.
And could you tell us a bit about your family background?
I was the youngest of 10 children. And when I was born, my father already had a business in East London, a wood-turning business. My parents actually were immigrants from Romania who came into London at the turn of the 20th century. All of our children were born in this country. And when the war broke out in 1939, I was obviously 19 years of age, having been born in 1920.
Stepping back a bit from that, tell us a bit about your family background. Right. I mean, what sort of a childhood did you have? You were a Jewish family. You've not mentioned that, but you were.
Yes, we were an Orthodox Jewish family who lived in an area which was mixed, mainly Jewish, but quite a mixed crowd of people, mainly Christian, because at that time, remember, there was no immigrants from the Far East or the Middle East or anywhere like that. You were either Christian or Jewish. We were the only two religions. When I say Christian, I mean Catholic or Protestant. To me, it was all classed as Christians. Now, I went to a Christian school.
Hang on. Don't jump ahead. It saves time. Tell us a bit about your family life. I mean, what was it like? How well off were the family? What sort of social circle?
I would think we were, for the area, rather middle class family, because my father had his own business, which he ran very successfully the time I was born, and I had a very, very loving family around me, and I enjoyed my childhood in the East End of London.
A reasonably comfortable house then.
We lived in the rooms above the shop, or the workshop rather, where we were working. And that was quite normal in those days.
Now, tell us about your education then.
Right. I started school, actually, in a church school called St. Mary's Church. I was the only Jewish boy in the whole of the school. I was brought up, actually, my first language was Yiddish, which was spoken in our house. So when I went to school at 3, I couldn't speak any English at all. So it was rather a tremendous experience for me to move into somewhere where I couldn't understand the language. But nevertheless, at the church school, I was treated as just the normal pupil there. I didn't find myself out of place in any way whatsoever.
Did you cope? Did you learn English quickly?
Oh, yes, very, very quickly. In fact, I taught my parents, like all the children did, how to speak English. My father and mother were unable to read or write English at all throughout all their lifetime. And I knew when I was at school, he used to come home and teach my father how to sign his name on a cheque. It was that sort of a background, but it was a loving background. And I can say nothing bad about my family upbringing.
Now, what about your education? How well did you do at St. Mary's School?
I stayed there till I was about 5 years of age. By that time, we'd moved into North London, a suburb in Stoke Newington, actually. And then I went to an ordinary council school. I stayed there till I was 14 years of age.
Now, how did you do at that school?
I thought I did extremely well. In fact, I passed what was now known as 11 plus. It was a exam to go to the secondary school, which meant staying at school till 16. But my father wanted me to come into the workshop to start work, and he insisted I leave at 14, which I did, and I was apprenticed there to become a wood turner.
Now, had there been any subjects you particularly liked or were good at school, or, you know?
Well, I thought I was good in mathematics, I was good in English, and I had no problems at school. There was a certain amount of anti-Semitism, which was normal for us at that time. There were certain areas in our district in which we would never go, because we knew we were at risk if we went there.
Now, what sort of anti-Semitism did you face then? Like, if we could just discuss that.
Well, remember, we're talking about the rise of Sir Oswald Mosley's fascist and Black Shirt Party. They had an office in the East End of London. Yes, because of the rise of Sir Oswald Mosley's party, it caused a lot of friction in the East End of London, because it stirred up any animosity that people might have had by his propaganda, and it made it very, very difficult for the Jews living in the area. In fact, very often there were battles in the East End of London. There was a big battle in Cable Street at the time, I remember, and I'm talking about thousands of people turned out and a pitched battle in the streets, so it was a really...
Did you see that?
Oh, yes, I was there in Aldgate at the time when Sir Oswald Mosley insisted that his black shirt party was going to march through the East End of London, which was primarily Jewish, just as an antagonistic move towards the Jewish people. And the Jewish people said they won't be allowed to march through their area. And because of the battle that took place there, the police had to call off Oswald Mosley's march at that time because it was impossible to control the crowds. In fact, many people were injured. I had a friend of mine who found himself being thrown through the glass plate window of one of the shops there. Because when I say a battle, it was quite a battle. It really was.
Now, what happened to you? What did you see? What were you doing?
I was there at the time, supporting the Jewish people against the march in the streets of London. It's known in history as the Battle of Cable Street.
Yeah, but what did you see? What did you do?
Oh, we did all sorts of things. Because we didn't... Although we were pretty violent, we never had any weapons or anything of that time, that sort of thing. We fought barricades. We struggled with them. People were leaning out of windows, throwing buckets of water at them. We just would not allow them any way to get through. The mounted police tried to come to clear us, but they couldn't succeed. It was an amazing sight. As I say, people were being thrown through plate glass windows, and it went on for some time. In fact, the police eventually had to tell Oswald Mosley that he'd better clear out away from the site because they just couldn't control the situation any longer.
Were you hurt in any way? Or?
No, I was one of the lucky ones. I didn't get hurt, except for a bit of bruising here and there, you know, pushing. But nothing serious like that. As I say, one of my friends finished up at London Hospital because he was thrown through the glass plate of the windows in Whitechapel. I remember that distinctly, and he was in hospital for some time. And there was several other casualties of that nature, but remember, it wasn't the time when there was guns, knives or that sort of thing. We didn't carry anything like that. It was mainly fisticuffs.
What about the day-to-day anti-Semitism? You said that, you know, there was...
There was always a certain amount before the war because the rise of Hitler was taking place in 1936. The propaganda was such that it was there was a great amount we felt in the political situation of sympathy for Hitler's cause. And so Oswald Mosley, as I say, had a great following of racists, black shirts. In fact, he formed an army of them. And this is what caused a lot of trouble. So this is what really started the real battles that we had, the anti-Semitic feeling that was going on, which we'd never had when I was a very young child because Hitler hadn't risen and Oswald Mosley hadn't risen at that time.
What sort of thing were they doing, the black shirts? Besides the march, I mean, you said that there was the incidents.
There was...
What sort of...
They had an office in... So Oswald Mosley had his offices in Gibraltar Walk in Shoreditch. He would have meetings at the top of Ridley Road in Stoke Newington, which was another Jewish area. He had a platform at Hyde Park Corner, Speaker's Corner, in which he was spouting very virulent anti-Semitic propaganda. There was no race relations laws or anything of that nature. You could say what you like and be as insulting as you like under the free speech of the country, and there was nothing anybody could do about it. He had the protection of the police all round him to protect him at all times, and we felt that he was causing most of the trouble and antagonism that was happening in the East End of London at that time.
But what sort of antagonism was happening? I mean, you know,
remember,
people being attacked? What was happening?
It was very, very difficult. There was physical attacks stirred up by them, and it was a time, remember, when Jews were barred from many jobs and industries in this country. A Jew could not get a job at the police force. A Jew could not get a job in any bank. A Jew had a very, very difficult time to find any sort of a job in the civil service. So it was a lot of restrictions on Jewish people at that time, which was perfectly normal because we grew up in that situation, so we knew the situation. But that was the situation we found ourselves in.
Were you or your family ever attacked?
Oh, yes, we used to get often attacked on the way home from school.
So tell us about people that. Used to, what would happen?
Well, the people, if we had to walk through an area which was not a Jewish area, the other children would throw stones at us and all sort of thing. We had to be extremely careful. So we had to know where to go and what times to go out. And we were extremely careful to take care of ourselves. But that was the normal way of living in our time. But we accepted it because being children, and this is all we ever knew, and we had a loving family behind us, as I said before, who looked after us extremely well. And mainly it was happy because our friends were Jewish, obviously, because that's where we found security and safety.
Now, were you an observant Jewish family? In other words, a religious
Yes,
Jewish.
As I say, I came from an Orthodox family, quite Orthodox.
So you followed the dietary rules?
Oh, yes. We were quite religious. The synagogue, every Saturday, went to the synagogue. We were brought up as Orthodox Jews, which we still are.
So you'd attend the church services and the church synagogue
services? Oh, yes, regular synagogue services, all the holidays, festivals and that sort of thing. Oh, yes.
Now, tell me about going to work. You were working as an apprentice machinist.
To my father, yes, as a wood turner.
Now, when did you start that? Was it
14 years of age.
1934,
yes.
And tell us a bit about your work in your father's
Well, my
work.
Father apprenticed me to his manager, a man named Mr. Goldberg. Because my father said to me at the time, you'll learn more from him than you will from me because he's not your father. And Mr. Goldberg was a very clever wood turner. He was really an experienced wood turner. Also an immigrant from Romania. And I worked under him. I was apprenticed to him for 5 years.
Now, that's 34 to 39. Then
that's right.
What sort of things were you doing? I mean, what were the skills of wood turning? What were you making and doing?
We were doing wood turning and hand carving as well. We worked for all the really stately homes, palaces, and all that sort of thing. We
so making some of that work there. Yes. Furniture.
No furniture. Just doing the turnery and the carving for them. Yes, and I'm still doing a little bit of it today.
Did you enjoy the work?
Oh, yes, I still enjoy it today because it's extremely creative. I worked just recently in the at Windsor Castle, you know, the fire that took place recently in Windsor Castle. Some of the restoration work that was done in there is my work there.
Okay, so that was a... as the war got closer, what did you think of what was going on? What was going on in Germany? What Hitler? The rest of it.
We knew exactly what was going on in Germany, but we had difficulty trying to convince the people in authority to believe us when we said about the atrocities that were being committed to the Jewish people by Hitler's Germany. But as I say, it's very difficult. The press was right wing. The government was very right wing. And it was very, very difficult to get over to them the dangers that lie ahead. And we could see it coming.
So we were aware of the early concentration camps? I mean, did you actually know about them?
We didn't know about the concentration camps at the time. But we did find out later on about them.
So you mean you knew about Kristallnacht and things
yes.
like that?
Oh, yes. We knew all about that. Can I just lay a myth here? Concentration camps... formed two forms of different concentration camps. The early concentration camps in 1939-1940 were based on the concentration camps, the first ones ever built by the British in the Boer War. That's where the concentration camps came from. They were prisons in which the prisoners were made to do forced labour. They were not extermination camps. The extermination camps weren't first built until 1943 or 44. And they were built in response to the situation that Germany found herself in after she attacked Russia and moved that far east and got to the gates of Stalingrad and Moscow and Odessa in the south. Because in that area of Europe was the greatest proportion of Jewish people in the world was congregated in the area of Eastern Europe. Hitler at that time found himself now with millions of Jews from which he didn't know what to do with. And he set up, I think it was in 1944, the 1C Conference. This is an historical place, which was chaired by a man named Adolf Eichmann. And the job of the 1C Conference was to come up with what they called the final solution.
But that's not, you didn't know that at the time. No. You've read that since.
Well, we knew it was going on. We knew that this was happening during the war. And we had news coming through because the Jewish people had people there who managed to get news out who told us what was going on. So although we knew it, we couldn't get the British government or the British people to take this into account. And it wasn't until the armies got that far east into Germany that they opened up these camps and found them for themselves, what we were telling them for quite a few years what was going on.
Now, what about the outbreak of war? I mean, you weren't in any of the services beforehand. I mean,
No, I'd never served. My father had served in the 1418 war. He came over here, as I said, turn of the century. He joined the British Army in the 1418 war.
Who did he serve with him?
I think he served in the Fusiliers. I've got a photograph of my father in the British Army uniform at that time, which is now in the Jewish Museum in Hendon.
And he served with the Jewish battalion, the Royal Fusiliers?
No, he served in the British Army.
With no English at all?
Oh, he spoke a bit of English by then, in 1418, yes. Because the children coming from school taught him English, so he could speak. But he couldn't read or write. He also became naturalised British when he joined the army. So he was a naturalised British subject at the time.
Now, tell us about the outbreak of war.
The outbreak of war, 1939, on Sunday morning. I remember it distinctly well. We knew it was coming. We expected it. And most of the people I knew wanted to join the army to fight. Because we felt we had a personal desire to get involved in this because we were fighting for people who we knew. Because my father, remember, had several members of his family still in Romania at that time, for which he had no news of them since Hitler came to power. And we had uncles, aunts, cousins and that sort of thing that were still there. It wasn't until after the war we found out that they had been exterminated in the camps, so we knew that they'd all been destroyed, all the family had gone. But we were concerned about them, so we had a little personal interest in this matter.
Now, did you actually hear the broadcast?
Oh, yes, Sunday morning, yes. Everybody sat round the radio and heard Winston Churchill say that Hitler had not responded to his call to retreat from Poland. And the result of that, this country is now at war with Germany. It was 11 o'clock in the morning war was declared. And immediately war was declared, the first air raid siren went off, quarter of an hour later, which was a false alarm, I remember at the time. And I had a girlfriend then, I was 19 years of age, I had a girlfriend who lived locally. And I was on my way round to her because of this momentous news about the war when the sirens went off, so I remember it very well. And, you know, people, first one they'd ever heard, didn't know how to react, you know, it was very, very difficult. Although before that, that we had been issued with gas masks, the public, because they were preparing for war anyway before the actual war was declared. And everybody was carrying their gas masks, and we didn't, you know, we managed anyway. We
what
carried
happened
on
with the false, or, you know, the air raid alarm? What did you all do?
Well,
what did you do?
I carried on just doing what I was doing. I just went to my girlfriend. I ignored it. I thought I was very fatalistic. I thought, if they want me, they know where I am anyway, wherever I will be, so I might as well play it through. And we did. And most people did that. They were very stoic. And, yes, I went round to my girlfriend, and we decided what we were going to do. And it was a very difficult time, and I said I wanted to join the army. And I decided before I would get into the army, I would get married. And I married my girlfriend when I was 20 years of age.
That's in 1940?
When I was 20, 1940.
And now, what made you decide to get married first before you joined the army? Some people decide not to get married, but to wait until they come out alive or not, you know. What made you decide to get married?
Looking back in retrospect, I wanted to marry this girl before anything happened to me in case I never came back from the army, because I wanted to join voluntarily to the army. So I thought I would get married and then I would join the army. But before I could join the army, I had my call-up papers arrive for me.
I'll come back to that.
Yeah.
Now, what about the air raid precautions? I know that the first year of the war was a bit of a phony, you know, till September 1940, there wasn't that much happened.
Yeah.
But what about, did you have an air raid shelter in Stoke Newington that was yours?
Or? Yes, because we had a garden. We had a house in Stoke Newington, and we had a garden, and they issued us with an Anderson shelter.
Now, who put it up? What was it like? Because people now don't know what an Anderson is like.
It was a sort of corrugated shelter which was put halfway into the ground. The other half was above the ground. But the hole that you dug out to put this into the ground, it was merely a corrugated sheeting, semicircular sheeting, and the earth was put over the top of the shelter, the dugout, the base of the thing. And we had a door in it, which we went into, and every time there was an air raid siren, you were supposed to go into the shelter, close the door, and hope for the best. And that's what we had as a shelter.
What was it like in there? I mean, was the furniture, any sort of furniture in there?
Well, we put forms and seats, and we took water in there and a bit of food. We prepared for all the eventualities, but I very rarely used it, because by that time I'd already gone into the army. I was in the army in 1940.
What was it? Yes, of course. What was it like in there, though?
It wasn't pleasant. In fact, a lot of people didn't like it because they felt very claustrophobic. They felt it didn't give them protection. And those who were fortunate enough to be anywhere near a tube station preferred at night, if the sirens went, to go down into the tube station.
Now, was it damp in your hands? Because some of them flooded.
Yes, they were. It was a damp area because you were underground virtually and there was no damp courses or anything of that nature. So it was just a means of protecting your life. I mean, the fact that it was damp, it was wet, it was cold in the winter and all that sort of thing was irrelevant. You were thinking of it at the time, because I remember when the bombs did fall, I came home and leave once or twice when there were bombing raids in London, and it wasn't at all pleasant.
Now, the other part of air raid precautions is the blackout. How did your family do the blackout? What was the method?
We got some black cloth. Every window was sheeted up with this black cloth, which was lined to make sure no light could get through the cloth. And no one turned on the light after dark unless all the blinds and the cloth were drawn over the windows to make sure there was absolutely no light shown. In fact, the streets were patrolled by wardens who would go round shouting at you if they saw a glimmer of light or a glint of light through any of the windows to black it out immediately, which we had to do. You know, they would knock at doors to make sure that was their job. These wardens used to make sure that there were no lights showing, no street lights, no sign. All the signs were removed from all the streets in London in case any parachutists came in, wouldn't know where they were.
What was it like being when you were out at night? I mean, I suppose you coming home from work, it'd be dark sometimes.
Oh, yes, well, it was dark, it was black. The cars had their lights, especially, they had special filters put over the lights of the cars so that the lights shouldn't shine upward, only shine down to the floor. And we couldn't use headlights, or just tiny dim lights. There was no such thing as traffic lights at that time because they came after the war anyway. So there were no traffic lights. All traffic was controlled by policemen on foot.
Now, what about the food rationing? And how did that apply? I mean, because there are strict dietary laws for observant Jewish families, aren't there? I mean, how did you cope with the rationing? Or did you use kosher butchers? Or how was it all done?
Right. We had our own supplies of food. If you wanted kosher, we had a kosher butcher. We had a kosher grocery store. We had a kosher baker. Our milkman was, we had kosher milk, just the same, it was coming just the same. But of course it was strictly rationed. All food it started off lightly, like certain foods were rationed, and gradually other foods came in, till eventually there was complete rationing of almost everything you had. Clothing was rationed. People had a book with coupons in, and you had so many coupons for each month. And when you used those coupons, that's all you had. I can't remember exactly the ration, because I wasn't so much at home. I was away at the army at the time, obviously. But I believe there was allowed about 1 ounce of butter per week per person, or something like that. I think we were allowed, bread rationing was very tight. I know we were only allowed to have so many slices of bread per week per person.
But there was no particular shortage of kosher food. Your normal
No more than anybody else. No more than anybody else. We weren't restricted any more than anybody else. We were allowed, for instance, we were allowed 2 ounces of meat. Well, we got 2 ounces of kosher meat, just like anybody else got 2 ounces of meat. And all other things, bread or anything like that, milk was rationed, whatever it was, we got the same ration as everybody else. There was no problem there whatsoever.
No problem at all.
No, it was difficult because you had to make do, and particularly when there's very little to eat, it's very, very difficult.
Now, what about the, how did the war affect you? Because for a year you were still at work. How did the war affect your sort of father's business and, of course, the business you were working for, apprentice?
To be quite frank, I could have applied for exemption to go into the army, because when the war broke out, we were immediately put on a war alert to make goods for the army.
Now, what goods?
And the goods we were told to make was, because remember, timber is imported into the country. We couldn't buy any timber unless you had a special license to buy timber. So we couldn't carry on with normal work like making furniture or anything like that unless you had a special license to do so. Because we were wood turners, we were spent the whole war, our firm spent the whole war making stretchers for poles for stretchers for the army, for the casualties. You know, the long pole that goes through the stretcher carrying people in the front.
And that's all you were making?
And we were making these poles all the time during the war, except for one or two other little things that might come in the army war if we might have wanted. But that was mainly it. And we made thousands and thousands, you can imagine, of these poles in which to, for the stretchers.
And so that was your thing?
Yeah. And I could have applied for exemption from going into the forces because of the fact that it was a reserved occupation, as we called it, what necessary for the war effort. But I wanted to volunteer anyway. I wanted to go, and I didn't want to reserve occupations. I wanted to go, like so many people of my age. We were eager to get into this fight because we thought it was our fight as well, and we should be there.
Now, you got married in 1940.
That's right.
And then you didn't actually volunteer in the end. They called you up. Now, what had happened to your reserved occupation status? And they just decided you weren't there.
No. Well, look, they sent you a notice, but I could have applied to have it rescinded because I'm in a reserved occupation. So you could apply if you were, for instance, a nurse or a doctor or some occupation which was valuable to the war effort as a civilian. You see, then you were left here if you had a particular job, you know, but I could have, but I didn't want to apply. I wanted to go. I was pleased to get the notice to go.
Now, what month were you called up?
I was called up in September 1940.
So just as the Blitz was starting it?
Yes. September 1940.
Was there any process? I mean, did you have a medical or anything?
Yeah. First of all, the first thing I had to do, I was sent to a medical centre in Tottenham for my medical examination.
And how strict, how real was it?
When I joined up, it was reasonably strict. We were checked for height, weight, eyesight, hearing, whether you had flat feet or not flat feet. As an ordinary doctor would, no x-rays or anything like that. They asked me if I had any illnesses, which I didn't have at the time. I was only 20 years of age. And that's it, and I was past day one.